All right, y'all ready? Do y'all remember the Mr. Lemon story? I think it was the marriage conference. Well, y'all didn't remember something else from the marriage conference. I bet you remember Mr. Lemon. So I'm pushing y'all, and y'all seem to be hanging in there. There was this old man at our church when I was a young man, and he was has long white beard. He was old as Alabama, man. He was old.
And we had somebody come and speak on relationships and marriage and all this. And they spoke for hours and all these complexities of dynamics and sub-dynamics of the marital interaction. And then they closed in prayer. And right before they, you know, right in that little silence before the chairs push back, after you say amen and there's that little silence, Mr. Lemon said, "I'm just glad I got married, for it got so complicated." So maybe that's how you're feeling. There's a lot of Mr. Lemon stories. One time I was walking through the hall as a teenager, and I passed Mr. Lemon in the hall. He says, "John." I said, "Hey, Mr. Lemon." He said, "John, you been reading your Bible?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, Mr. Lemon, been reading it." He said, "You been reading it every day?" I'm like, "Oh, yes, sir, Mr. Lemon." "Well, we've had it in the lost and found here at the church the last 6 months. If you want to come and get it." All right, some items of business. I think it's on your handout. Does your handout have the Google Voice number, a phone number on there? Okay, I started using that when I was doing marriage conferences because, you know, you do a parenting conference and people follow you to the car with questions, you know. You're like rolling up the window like, okay, so... But at a marriage conference, I wanted to create some opportunity for people to have a little privacy to ask, you know, what if my spouse is a rageaholic, you know, and he's kind of sitting next to him. So this will text me to my little Google Voice number. If you have a question, I want to do a lot of Q&A as much as we can and talk about some of these things. So many of y'all have already had just cool things like what you said reminded me of this, and I want that. That's community too. Y'all help me put meat on the bones of this. But if you have a question that's a little more delicate or personal or vulnerable, I welcome you to text it to me. I never get to all of them at a conference. And it always makes me feel bad for the people who've given me this personal question and we don't get to it. So I may not be able to get to it, but I invite you to try. And we've already talked about the podcast. The books are right around there on the corner. It's self-serve. You can put a check in the envelope or Venmo me or whatever like that. It's kind of, what do you call it? Honor system. Take a book. Yeah. If you need to steal a book on why God loves us, then blessed be to you. Anyway, the parenting book is twofold. It is what kids need to fill in the software for the little squares and what to do when you screw it all up. Because, I mean, I'm dealing with parents all the time, and it's like their biggest fear is what if our kids turn out to be, you know, codependents or whatever like that. And so a lot of the point of the book is one of the things I've learned is that if we repair those failures with our kids, it's really actually better love. And the God book is probably my favorite thing I've ever done. It's called The One Story A Psychologist Reaches for the Heart of God. And it's the story of how our redemption, how God's love for us doesn't just start when Jesus arrives in Matthew. That from the beginning, even in Eden, God is unfolding this picture of his passion and his heart for us. And all the stories of the patriarchs, of Noah and Abraham and Moses. It's just something I've loved doing my whole life. And one of the elders of my church grabbed me by the scruff of the neck one day and said, "Write it in a book. I'm an elder. I'm telling you to do it." And I'm like, "Yes, sir." All right. But it turned out to be something I really have loved. All right. So we got Abba going. And we've got attachment, we've got boundaries, third food group. Let's see, where shall I write this? I think I'm gonna... Let's keep our little squares there because that's kind of fundamental. The next one is badness. All right, infants search for connection, belonging, and attachment. Toddlers, they're having a sense of self and me. What do school-age kids complain about? Think about it. That's not fair. His piece is bigger. I hate our minivan. The Joneses got a big screen and we got a little screen. You know, we want a batting cage. My soup's got thingies in it. In other words, there's a funny thing about that age is they start making sense in a deeper, more frontal lobe awareness way of how much life stinks. Brian alluded to the yuck earlier, the yuck in life, how life hurts, how life disappoints me, how you let me down, how there's pain in life, and things that are bad about me. What else do little kid? What else do school-age kids complain about? I struck out. I'm no good. Think about it. One minute they're like, "Look, Ma, no hands," and they're like, "I'm going to quit baseball. I struck out." So they don't know how to make sense of good and bad at all right? So this one's about dealing with pain, sorrow, judgment, loss. God talks about this one a lot. It's a biggie. He calls it forgiveness, repentance, humility, getting the log out of your eye, suffering, grief. The Bible is so much about this one, and it's really a tough one. And one of the reasons it's such a tough one is because of all of the four food groups that I'm teaching you tonight, this is the only one we were not created to have to learn. Like, our operating system doesn't run this one. It's like you're an Apple and you're trying to run a PC software on it. I mean, if Adam and Eve hadn't fallen, I imagine there would have been a growth curve for them as they learned more about attachment and connection and love and how to love God and how to be known. Part of their growth in the garden would have been about love. And what's the first commandment in Scripture? Be fruitful and multiply, name the animals, subdue the earth, go be a steward, show some power, engage the world, baby. There would have been a big movement in their lives about ruling and stewardship. And our fourth one is going to be about emotional management. They would have had to learn about that. How to manage my impulses. Obviously, they didn't manage that one very well. Just saying. But we were not designed to know this. We're fish out of water. We're like driving a Ferrari duck hunting, all right? We're not made for this. It's one of the reasons that all of us struggle with it so much. We were created to live in perfection, so most of us don't have a clue how to deal with this. So a really challenging part of childhood and a challenging part of parenting is that we have to help somehow teach our kids to do this. There's two directions we could go with this. I'm going to go one of them tonight and one of them tomorrow. Because this yuck can be about shame and judgment. Or this yuck can be about loss and pain. How am I supposed to make sense of my badness? How am I supposed to make sense of my loss? I'm going to do this one now, and we'll do this one tomorrow, because they're too much to take in one bite. So let's talk about shame and judgment and how we have to make sense of that. People talk about not shaming your children, but the problem is, if you're a Christian psychologist, you know that we're all born with shame. It's not like our children come out with these little hearts that are so innocent and comfortable with their failures. We come out with shame. That's what it means to be born under the law. That's why you can see that little kid, you know, that toddler, and you say, "Don't pick up that marker on the dry erase board," and they go, I mean, like, they know, you know? They know about good and evil. They're already knowing something about what's wrong and what's right and what's good and what's bad. They have a notion of shame. If we're going to learn the software, at this level, one of the things that has to be taught to us that does not come natural is we need to unshame children. It's not just, hey, be careful and don't shame them. We actually got to pull them out of the pit, all right? We need to have experiences in our lives. And again, don't guilt trip your parenting here. That's why it's called good setting parents free, okay? We need to have experiences in our lives growing up and now. It's not too late. We'll talk about this tomorrow. In which somebody sees my badness, in which somebody sees my fallenness, my limitations, my sin, my weakness, and their eyes don't fall. And their response is kind of a welcome to the club. What's that Brene Brown thing? The cure for shame is me too. Y'all heard that? This is one of the reasons I talk so much in the parenting book about good enough parenting, because what I say is the solution. Let me tell you what really great parenting is. Really great parenting is when you do the best you can as this fallen person that you are. And guess what? You're going to lose it sometimes, or you're going to be too busy sometimes. You're going to miss that precious moment with your child sometimes, or you're going to snap at them sometimes, and you're going to screw up. And the moral of the story is, because of Christ, we get to swing back and repair that. And you can say to your child, I messed that up. I wasn't kind to you. I didn't tune into you when you needed me to. I popped off at you in a mean way, and I bet that was scary. Now, that does two things at once, which is so cool. One thing it does is it repairs the injury. But the other thing it does is it starts to unshame children, because what did you just tell them? I am part of a club of people who mess stuff up all the time. Watch, I just did it. In other words, I love to tell parents this. One of the ways we teach children about God's grace is by showing them when we need God's grace. So in terms of beginning to build the software of, is it safe to be fallen? Is it safe to be bad? We're starting to build this category of, well, I'm bad. I mess up all the time as your dad. And I'm not afraid to talk to you about it. And I'm not afraid to engage you about it. It's safe. Now, you know, knuckleheaded psychologists will go, it's okay to be bad. It's okay to be this bad sinner person. It's not okay. You can look at the cross and see it's not okay. But it's safe. Jesus made it safe. And the way we heal shame, and this is in the background of everything I'm doing tonight. This is in the background of me confessing to you guys that I made this up. It might not be any good because it's safe. Y'all are safe to do that too. And I want you to see that I feel safe with you. The point of this night is look at all the places that you're broken. And you know what? It's safe. We're going to make that safe here. We're just going to list the ways in which we're all broken, and it's safe. That combats the biggest enemy to growth, and one of the biggest enemies to community, and that is shame. Why am I so offended with unsolicited advice? I think you ought to do so and so. Why does that push our buttons? Why does that bug us? What are you saying about me? It's shame. Why am I afraid to tell you the truth about how I struggle? Shame. Why do I judge you? Because one of my favorite ways to deal with shame, one of my favorite ways to deal with my own shame, is to have a Mardi Gras party about how bad you are. In other words, a lovely way to make myself feel better is to judge other people. So if we're going to talk about community, we need to realize how much of an enemy shame is to that. Who was it who said, what would it be like to have to walk around with a big sign around your neck with your biggest sin on it? And the answer was, it'd be easy because no one would notice because they'd be so busy covering their own. So when we struggle here, we will go two directions. Are y'all getting the theme here? We will judge self, or we will judge others. It's harder to write on this side. Y'all thought it was a legible over there. It's good enough. All right. Judging ourselves. This is where we're driven by shame. Guys, double click this one to favorites because it drives everything. I felt some anxiety this week about this conference. And I'm like, dude, why are you anxious? And I'm like, because I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm going to be embarrassed if I bomb. And I'm like, dude, you're feeling shame. And I was. My shame was creating anxiety. I was afraid I wouldn't do a good job. Okay? You ever feel that kind of feeling? This is where our core questions really show up a lot. How much are we walking around asking, am I good enough? Do you think I'm good enough? So we hide. How y'all doing? Fine. How about y'all? Or we posture. We create that false self. So what does shame mean? Let's unpack it just a little bit. Technically, shame is, and this is a little shrinky, but sorry. Shame is the experience we have of our badness being exposed outside of the context of love, and the fear that that will result in a loss of connection. Shall I say it again? Shame is the experience of my badness being exposed outside of the context of love, and my fear that that will result in a loss of connection. Remember love? This thing that was the root and the grounding of everything we're doing in our software development. Isn't it interesting, by the way, how the greatest of these is love? It's really cool to be a Christian psychologist because the more you understand how humans work, the more you go, oh, wait, this is kind of what God's been saying all along. Oh, duh, you know. But remember the love thing? Here we are again. I am terrified. Shame says, I am terrified. If you really see me, you're going to pull away from me. You're going to hear me doing this talk, and you're not going to like it, and you're not going to like me. You know, the worst feeling for a speaker, speakers know this feeling, is when you realize the audience has moved past being bored and uninterested in what you're saying, and they're starting to actually feel sad for you. Like, how much longer is he going to have to go? Because I just don't want him to have to suffer anymore. You know, that kind of thing. Shame says something about me. It's not I've done something bad, it's I am despicable. It's that humiliation, it's that embarrassment, and it will destroy our souls. God was not speaking metaphorically when he said, the day you eat of it, the tree of shame, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know, in Hebrew, knowledge meant an intimate connection with. Like Adam knew his wife Eve, the knowledge of good and evil. And so Adam and Eve have the sense. That's why we're always thinking, is it good enough or bad enough? Am I cute enough or not? Am I cool enough? Is my car cool enough? We're always judging, committing the second sin in a sense. God said, the day you eat of it, you will die. And he wasn't kidding. Doesn't it kill you every day? One of the ways it kills us, two ways shame kills us. I see this in the office all the time. Heck, I see it in my own life. Since shame feels so scaldingly horrible to feel, humans will do almost anything to not feel it. Pick a pathology. We will get eating disorders. We will gossip. We will look at porn. We will shut down and get depressed. We will get rageful and attack other people. We will get panic disorder. We will do anything to not feel shame. So shame drives us into our worst pathology. Basically, a lot of the time at work, if I'm working with somebody, almost pick a card, any card with symptoms. And we can talk more about symptoms tomorrow when we talk about growth. So keep up with those questions. Behind so much pathology is shame. But that's not even the worst part. Remember, let me tell you the worst part. The worst thing about shame. Remember back at 6:25? We were talking about shame. I mean, we were talking about love. And I drew a gorgeous little drawing of a potted plant. And I said, if you put that plant in a closet, it withers. And if you take humans away from connection with other people, they wither. And we'll talk about this more tomorrow, but the only place that humans ever grow at the heart deep core level is when they are in connection with other people. And let me ask you a question. When you feel shame, where do you want to go? As far away to the plant closet, baby. Yeah. The worst problem is exactly. Shame creates the worst problem in the world and destroys the solution for it. Yeah. We were talking about humility earlier. Why is humility so hard? Well, some of it's because of our sin. I want to be 10 feet tall, good looking, and bulletproof, and you not be. All right? Basically, pride. Christians are always blaming stuff on pride. Pride is not that I want to have mastery or be good. Pride is I want to be better than you. Pride is always comparative. But the other reason that humility is hard is, again, I'm going to keep coming back to this with each of our four food groups. We are terrified. Unless we really have shame healed, unless we have a safety that for me to be broken and fallen is safe, then humility feels like humiliation, and I will not do it. Sometimes I talk about this and people will say, but yeah, but you shouldn't we feel shame like about our sin? No. I think there's a place, shame is kind of trendy now. Like hating on shame is kind of trendy now. I think there's actually a place for shame with unrepentant people. But as I've told you, that's a different show. And we can go there. But generally, should we feel bad about our sin? Yes. Should the bad feeling that we feel about our sin be shame? No. It should be that feeling that the New Testament calls godly sorrow, the sorrow that leadeth unto repentance. In other words, yes, we should feel bad about our shame, but that badness, that bad feeling should not be shame. It should be a deep humility. In other words, shame used to be appropriate. Before God came looking for Adam and Eve, they needed clothes. In fact, remember one of his blessings to them? He made them better clothes. He said, fig leaves ain't going to do it. That's not going to cover your shame. I got to make you better clothes. And one of the things I talk about in the book is, don't you think it's interesting that in order to make them clothes out of animal skins to cover their shame in the garden, there already had to be a shedding of blood in the Garden of Eden to cover their shame. And God's story has been about killing shame until he finally nailed it to the cross. So it's not appropriate anymore. It drives us away from hope and it drives us away from love. It drives Adam and Eve away from saying, God, we've made a huge mistake. No, they're hiding. And now instead the answer is, the answer is that passage in Hebrews. You want to understand shame? and the answer to shame. The passage in Hebrews, I don't even know the verse right now. For the joy set before him, Jesus endured the cross, and he sat on the right hand of God the Father. I love that word, despising the shame. He despises it. It's like he looks at it and he says, you can't have him. You want to shame somebody, shame me. I will take it. I want to infect you with unshame. And I want to burden you with a broken heart. Because what we should feel instead of shame is something that's actually more painful in some ways. And that is that we really are people with little squares that are broken and missing software. And this community of people, we will hurt each other. If you're going to trade in your shame, trade it in for the glory of the cross and trade it in for the heartbreak of the truth. That don't feel shame about your brokenness. Feel broken about your brokenness. That's the best community I could teach you about. All right, number two. One of the ways that we act if we are not safe with shame is we will judge others. Again, what's the first thing Adam and Eve do after they sin is they start blaming. Y'all remember the joke from the marriage conference? What does Adam do when God says, "Where are you?" He does what every self-respecting husband would do. He blames his wife. The woman you gave me. The problem with judgment is it literally invents another person more screwed up than me so I don't have to feel shame. That's my solution. Instead of having a Savior who saves me or my own humility who comes to you in brokenness, I invent somebody who's more screwed up than me. What else is wrong with judgment? I find judgment to be so interesting, and I love how much the Bible talks about it. Let me ask you a pop quiz Sunday school question. What's wrong with me judging you for being bad? I mean, you are bad, right? We're Presbyterians. Judgment is not bad because of what it says about you. You are bad. Judgment is destructive because of what it implies about me, which is what? That I'm not bad. Exactly. And that is, within Jesus' world, that is a dangerous place to live. He has one of the scariest names in the Gospels for people who live in that position. A, he says, enjoy it. That self-righteousness. Make yourself a big glass of sweet tea and get in your hammock because that's your reward in full. But the other thing, he has a word for people who live there, and it frightens me. He calls them the well. Like in Mark 2. And why is that scary? Because who is it who does not get a visit from the great physician? In other words, judgment, me better than you. Man, this is so an infection in marriages. What do we do in marriage but blame each other? Judgment puts me on the curb from the hand of the healer as long as I'm living saying you're the bad one. I'm not living as someone who needs his mercy. This is one of the secrets to forgiveness, by the way. Several of y'all have talked to me about my forgiveness talk on the podcast. Thank you. I'm working on a forgiveness book right now. Give me your prayers about it. But what we're talking about here about the mutuality of fallenness, of not standing over you in judgment, I think is one of the secrets to making forgiveness work. Because for human beings, we don't forgive out of our benevolent loving kindness like God does. Humans forgive because who are we to talk? In other words, we're not letting someone off the hook when we forgive them. We're recognizing we're on the same hook. And I think that core to being in community is being a good forgiver. Now again, dynamics with unrepentant people, repeat offenders, it's different rules. All right, but with a repentant person who has that Romans 7 experience, forgiveness means recognizing not, oh, I release you from your debt. No, it's like we are both in such a debt. That ungrateful servant parable where the guy's forgiven like 70 zillion denariuses, you know, and his brother owes him one, you know, and he won't forgive him that. That's what forgiveness means for us. So we can discern, we should discern, but the moment that discernment means I'm better than you, that's judgment, and we are in trouble. Here's a little throw out for the unrepentant people dynamic. What do you do if somebody judges you? You're so-and-so. One of my little tricks, little techniques, I got a lot of little tricks for dealing with unrepentant people. I like to equalize with judges. They're like, I can't believe you're so bad that you do something like that. I want to say, yeah, isn't it amazing how broken and fallen we all are? And they go, no, I mean you. And you go, yeah. You know, actually, if you're going to talk about me and my badness, you don't know the half of it. Don't get me started. You're not going to like what you see. I love to see someone shame, call them and raise them one. In other words, shamers don't know what to do if you're not afraid of shame. Like, you're the worst speaker I've ever heard. I'm going to go, you mean publicly or privately? Because I can be worse privately. You know, if you show them you're not afraid of shame, you win, because that's all they've got. Anyway, preview of coming attractions if you want to go there. All right, fourth food group, and then we'll do questions. Yay, we got tons of questions, tons of time. I'm going to call awareness. What else did I call it? I struggled to find an A. Oh, yeah, agency. I had to work to get that ABBA. Very helpful category. What kind of trouble do they get into? Making stupid choices, doing impulsive knuckleheaded stuff, you know, driving up, you know, the Bass Music Center with the angels and stuff, you know, driving there with their head hanging out and steering with their foot. They do those kind of things, right? And we have our fourth category, which is awareness. This one is about emotional management. And in some ways, it's kind of the hallmark of adulthood. Notice how these move up in complexity developmentally. All this is getting love, baby. All this is having a sense of me, like saying no. This one's dealing with shame. This one's actually managing my entire emotional world, which if you look at 21st century America, you can see we're complete failures at, all right? Whatever side of the political spectrum you're on, all right? This is the ability to have a feeling. FX is shorthand for feeling in my world, okay? Or to feel a feeling, and here's the punchline, you ready? Wait for it, and not do a feeling. All right, this means the kids are driving me crazy, and I wanna scream. Can I manage that and not scream? See, gotcha, all right? This is, can I feel the feelings of lust and not act on them? Can I be mad at my wife and not say what I've been wanting to say? Okay? Most of us can't. Can I feel empty and not eat? Can I feel scared about my kids and not overprotect? When we are born in our little square, we do not have the ability to have a feeling without doing a feeling. You notice this with your children. The reason this is so is because children are born concrete. Let's do a little developmental psychology. Children are born concrete thinkers, all right? Like my 2.5-year-old granddaughter Dottie was running around the kitchen the other day as fast as she could. And her mother, my daughter Callie, goes, "Callie, what are you doing?" And Dottie says, "I'm running errands." Okay, that's concrete thinking, people, all right? I used to make my kids a sandwich, and they go, "I want two sandwiches." So I'd cut it in half and go, "Here, you got two sandwiches." They're like, "Okay." You know, that's concrete thinking. This is why Sesame Street doesn't talk about the concept of threeness. It talks about 1, 2, 3, cookie, okay? They're concrete. They're concrete thinkers, but they're also concrete feelers. So you don't take them to check at all, refuse to get them the bubblicious, and they say, "You know, I got to tell you, I was really looking forward to it. And now I feel disappointed. I'm sad, too. I'm actually feeling a little angry as well, just to let you know." No, they fall out on the floor, right? They do their feelings. So before we have software here, we have feelings and we do them. Now, somewhere along the line, we develop this ability to where some guy can be tailgating you on the way to Dallas, and you think, "Man, I'd love to slam onto my brakes and the guy just run in the back of me." But you don't. Hopefully. Okay? Somewhere we learn the software to have a feeling and not do that. So the two directions we can go is what I've been talking about. We can act out our feelings, or we can be what I call colorblind. And I'm still working on that theory, so this is going to be a little rough. But hey, y'all are my guinea pig group, okay? All right, acting out is where we do our feelings, like I said. All right, I got to tell you all this story. I used to park in the parking garage. And I can garage at my building now, park in the doctor's parking. But I used to park in the parking garage. And I'm coming back from lunch, and I have a 1 o'clock client. And I'm in a big hurry. It's 1 o'clock. And I got to get parked. I got to get down the garage. I got to get up the building. I got to get in my office at my 1 o'clock. And my job, if you're 5 minutes late, you're 5 minutes late the rest of the day, okay? So I'm like behind this person, though, who's going 2 miles an hour up the parking garage. You know these people? And they're looking, I can see them in the back, they're looking in every car to see maybe if there's somebody in a car who's gonna back out and give them a spot. And I'm thinking, I gotta go, there's a lot of spaces up higher, come on. And they're tooling and looking both ways. And finally, I just go, "Nee, nee, 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 nee," on my horn. And that it works. They speed up. They go up and they find a parking place and they get out and they are my 1 o'clock. So we were talking about shame and therapist. I had to tell them. I can't hide that from them. They said, "Sorry I'm late," but I said, "It was hard getting in the garage and there was some jerk." I'm like, me too. I was acting on my feelings. That's behind half of the crazy junk you do, all right? Same with people who are reactive with their emotions. I love the people who are like, instead of saying, "I'm kind of scared about your job and like where we are financially, could we talk about it?" They're like, "What are we going to do? We're going to be living in a van down by the river." Hey, I'm just sharing my feelings. No, you're not. You're carpet bombing your feelings, you know? They're like, you know. So, did I learn to manage emotional reactivity when I see the crazy junk in my life? Some of that is your sinfulness. And yet you'll be very intrigued at how much you can learn to manage that sinful part of you as you develop the ability to have a feeling and not act on it. We'll talk more about how that works tomorrow. But can I hear a sermon, something in the sermon I don't like? I don't have to grab Brian after church or write him a Sunday afternoon email. He paid me to say this. He said, just throw that in. Would you just throw that in at some point? Can I be mad at you and not need to act on it? Can I be, like we were saying earlier, that curiosity of why is this pushing my buttons? All right? Can I have a feeling and not do it? Huge piece for the little squares. Now, secondly, colorblind, and we'll wrap up and do Q&A. Here's the deal. That's kind of a Joe Biden thing to say, wasn't it? Here's the deal, folks. When we're talking about emotion, everybody expects psychologists to talk about emotion, right? We're going to talk more about it tomorrow. But when we talk about emotion, it's not like we're just having some touchy-feely time, okay? Because emotion is actually the sense with which we perceive the emotional and relational world. Emotion is information. One of the reasons that I'm not going to act on it is because if I listen to it, if I learn about it, we'll talk about this a lot tomorrow. If I learn about it, I will learn stuff you don't learn any other way. In other words, I call it your sense of feel. And it's like your sense of touch, or you're like your sense of sight. Like your sense of touch tells you, ooh, don't touch that stove, it's hot. Your sense of feel gives you information about the world. Did that apology feel genuine? Did that remark feel cutting? Is there something in me that's given too much power to that person because I'm feeling all this fear of what they think about me? Huh, interesting. Now I'm listening to myself. Emotions are information. That's why you're missing out on a ton of information. It's like telling me you're hard of hearing. There's so much information going on in that emotional world. Can you feel that I'm engaged with this conference with y'all tonight? Can you feel that I really care about this and I'm excited about it? How do you know? That's your sense of feel. Everyone shake hands with your sense of feel, all right? Anyway, that's your sense, your awareness. You pick up on the genuineness. That's a huge thing that feelings do. And if we don't learn that, we go through the world in that kind of digital left brain, often ignore connection kind of way, and we miss out being a little ham-handed, hurting other people in the way that we relate, all right? All right, that's John's big picture of how humans work, all right? Congratulations. And it's how we don't work, so welcome to the club. In other words, what do you call a screwed up person who becomes a Christian? A screwed up Christian, okay? And you're sitting with them, all right? Our only options are to be broken and incomplete, or to be a liar, or to be someone who thinks they're not broken, which is actually the most destructive kind of person. But when we get honest about how we are broken, I think what it does is it starts to restore that created order that Adam and Eve broke, where God says, I want you to be small and needful and humble and under me. That's what it means to wait upon the Lord. When we talk about sin later, we'll talk about how some of the essence of sin is taking. I don't have, I am vulnerable, I am need, and instead of waiting upon the Lord, instead of being small or broken or incomplete or growing, I'm going to take. And as we start to look honestly at the kind of things we're talking about tonight, what does brokenness look like? What does that little square incompleteness mean? And we start to accept that that's part of my story, and that's part of the story of everybody in my community. Not only is that going to make us safe as people who can be little squares together, but it brings us back to that place where God calls us to be. I love the way how in Scripture God says in so many different ways that his gaze is not unilateral, that his gaze is directed, and that his gaze is so often upon the broken or the lost or the lonely or the needful. And that's why Jesus finds the one sheep. It's why he pulls a little child to him and says, unless you become like one of these, when we are broken, when we see this incompleteness and when we see it together, God promises that he inclines his ear to the humble. And he promises that if we are willing to die, I haven't told y'all this, but tonight's been about dying. You want to know what dying to self is? A lot of it is dying to the belief that you got it all together. If only you tried harder. No, we're all a mess. And I think Jesus' message is, if you die, if you're willing to look and say, have mercy on me, the sinner, that he promises he will raise us up. And tonight I've wanted to go to that broken place with y'all about all that's messed up in us and to train our gaze, our attention to look in the same places that God's does to the broken and to the humble. That's community. Let's do questions. And I will check my phone.
Okay. Oh, hi.
I got a couple of questions here, but I'm going to take your question. Yes.
Okay. My question is really with regard to the boundaries issue. You talked about how, you know, it's, you can't be on empty, and that's not good. And I've heard that you can't pour from an empty cup and all of that. But where, how do you know how far your tank can be empty to be able to say no? For something that's good, but you're just exhausted, and but maybe there's, you know, where's the line? How do you know when it's an okay thing to do to say, no, I'm going to protect my peace without that I'm going to protect my peace being a selfish thing?
Yeah. I love that question. That's cool. All right, can I ask you a slight follow-up? Without that being selfish, and what does that mean?
Really, like, what's the Christian thing to do? What's the... I know that's just so vague. Being because I don't want to versus doing so is going to make me worse off for...
See, I'm glad I asked. That's such... That's an even more difficult question.
Yeah.
A more interesting question. All right. How do I know when I'm drawing a limit of a boundary... what I cannot do, and how can I be learning, let's use that word, learning to discern to what degree that's coming out of a genuine need and to what degree a part of me just is not wanting. Ah, that's cool. I asked them, I said, will they play with me? And they said, oh yeah, they'll play with you. This is good. Okay, here's just some thoughts. That's off the top of my head. One of the things that we'll talk about tomorrow, we're going to talk about, okay, so we're all a screwed up mess. High five. Now, what does it look like to grow together? What is our goal? What would loving love look like? If I'm in a place of need, how can you give to me? If you're in a place of need, how can I best approach you? We're going to learn about sort of, we're going to deconstruct love and growth in that part of community tomorrow. And one of the things that we'll say is that, I alluded to it here tonight, with the issues of our heart, it is very difficult to do that by myself. And one of the things we'll talk about tomorrow regarding hearing someone, we'll talk about how important it is to hear someone if they come. If I come to you and I go, hey, I'm really depressed, what do you want to do? like tell me how to get undepressed, right? But we're going to talk about the dynamic of being heard. And one of the reasons we're going to be heard is because most people don't know exactly what's going on inside. All right, so one of your answers is, I want to get curious with a friend about that question partially. I want to say, okay, you know me. As far as I'm aware, consciously, and before the Lord, I feel myself called to do this. I love it. I love what he's called me to do here. I love a way I can serve here, this person I'm given to there. I feel a passion in my heart toward the kingdom. So I don't think I'm just, man, I don't want to. Do you see anything in me that's kind of, man, I don't want to? And I would want to ask that. All right, but part of the question is, if you have that part of you that does delight in doing the will of God, that's a good litmus test where this is what it feels like when you do it because you want to do it, not because you're supposed to do it, all right? Now, your second question is a little vaguer, but that's good. All right, I'll tell you how I've answered it. The other part of her question, how do you know when to draw the boundary? I learn by doing it wrong. In other words, I've ended up on the side of the road without any gas and no spare tire. And I'm like, I think I should have said no. All right? Like, when I was young, I would work all Friday morning, catch a plane to do a conference, show up and do the conference, you know, burn it out here on Friday night and Saturday morning, get on a plane, fly home on Sunday, and go to work on Monday. Ah! All right? And then I turn about 60, and I'm like, depressed. Like going, I hate conferences. And I'm like, what is that about? And I'm like, John, you're an old man. You don't have that mojo anymore. What do you need? And I realized I needed to start taking Mondays and Tuesdays off. But I had to be sitting in a hotel room in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, depressed before I knew that, okay? So what I want to get people away from is the vibe that listening to that gas needle that's saying, I'm miserable and I need something is wrong. And you ask the good guard question first. Am I just being like, I don't want to do it? And I don't hear that in you. And I want us to listen for that. If it's something in me that just does not want to be a good steward, talk to somebody about that. But the only way I've ever known to draw that line exactly where the needle is I have to go over the needle and go, oh, let's back it up a little bit. I have to screw it up first. But then again, I'm not that smart. That was a cool question. Thank you. I'll look at the phone. How would you counsel someone who in the past has not been curious, but has leaned toward being judgmental? How would you help that person begin to heal the relationships in which they've hurt others? Okay, so I'm trying to read your question. It's like someone in the past who's not been curious but has enjoyed being judgmental, and they've started to see the error of their ways, and they're realizing they've hurt other people. How would you help them begin to heal the relationships in which they've hurt others? All right, my first question, if we go this direction, you're going to get tired of hearing me say this. But the first question in a situation like this is, are they repentant or unrepentant? And the writer is implying they've seen the error of their ways, which means they're like, I've been a judgmental, unrepentant, jerky person, and now I don't want to be that way anymore. That's Jesus's love language, all right? And when they're repentant, then I bet they're going to ask you, how do I help heal those relationships in which I've hurt others? If they're not, you can ask them, you know, I really appreciate your apology. And it means a lot how much you've seen how hurtful you've been. Thank you. Would you be willing to help me heal some of the ways in which you've hurt me? Now, that's going to be your tell whether their apology is genuine. Because the jerky person who's just apologizing for apologizing's sake, I'm sorry, come on, get over it, and you say, yeah, thanks for the apology. Will you help me heal the ways you've hurt me? They're going to go, for crying out loud, you know, and you're going to learn they're not that apologetic after all. That's why people can get in a apologize toxic loop with an unrepentant person. Because today I'm screaming and yelling at you. Tomorrow I'm bringing you roses and I think everything's great. But day after tomorrow I'm going to be yelling at you again. I don't really like apologies. I like repair. And that's why this person's question is so insightful. Because they're saying, how would you help that person begin to heal those relationships? Let me ask you, if you have been hurt by someone who is judgmental or cutting, what would you need to hear from them in order to heal that injury? Bueller, anyone? Anyone? I understand. Love it. What's the saying? The feeling of being gotten and understood is so close to the feeling of being loved that they're almost indistinguishable. So you want to heal an injury? I get it. And I might even talk to you about it. When I talked to you that way, it must have made you feel like a piece of garbage. Like you didn't matter at all. And you know how you can tell if you're on the right track, if you're the apologizer? What else might you need? If you did hurt. That's your sweet spot. What else might you need if you've been hurt, judged? We could kind of close in prayer with that one. How about this? Ooh. All right. I'm going to give you a hint at this one because it's too cool to talk about right now because we're going to talk about it tomorrow. Accountability. What do you call confession without accountability? A party. In other words, I'm real sorry, man, but I'm going to do it again tomorrow, okay? How about this? I'm real sorry. I get it. I care. I want to help restore this. And I tell you what, I tell people who've been injured to ask the injurer this question. When they say, I'm sorry, I promise I won't do it again, to ask them, wow, that's so meaningful. What do you want me to do next time you do? And if they go, well, what do you mean? I've never, okay, don't trust them. I saw a couple once, and he was physically abusive. And he was telling his wife, okay, I'm never going to do it again. And she's like, he's like, come on, I'm never going to do it again. And it's kind of irritating me. So I asked him, I said, well, I'll tell you what. If you're never going to do it again, why don't you tell her what she can do to you if you ever do it again? I mean, since you're so certain you'll never do it again, it can be pull out a 44 Magnum and, you know, you're that sure. And he said, call the cops. And she looked at him. He said, yeah. You call the cops on me. And she started to melt. He said, I want a blue light special in the front yard. I want the neighbors coming out in their bathrobes wondering what the deal is, because the deal is me. And she and I both started crying. I want accountability if they had that history. Getting it and accountability. How about that? Yes, ma'am. Rachel?
Lauren.
Shoot. Sorry.
You were so certain.
I'm trying to remember y'all's names.
Okay.
Remember what I said about calling somebody's name aloud?
Yeah.
Bob.
It's okay. I'm bad at names.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, okay. In the church context, So when do you know, okay, I need to go talk to this person because it's not going away? Either you hurt them, or they hurt you, or it's just you've had a run-in with somebody at the church and it wasn't even a big deal. You know, you're like, I don't even know if they remember it, but there was this one thing that this person said, or maybe it was longer than that and it was like, we did a Sunday school class together and the whole time it was hard or something. So you have these different people within the body, but you're just like, I don't want to stir it up, and you start thinking about, I'm the little square, and your heart kind of melts, and it was just their little square, and so you're kind of thinking about it through the context of the conference, or if I'm going home tonight thinking about people that I just want to have, like, just be super loving towards and not hold grudges against people in our church family. But how do you know when it's like, it would be really helpful if I talk that out? And how do you know to go, it's really just my problem, and I think I can forgive them without talking it out? You know what I mean?
I'm learning. Let's keep playing hypothetical. Hypothetically, how much would you see this person continuing to live out that pattern in their relationships now? Was that a 2 years ago in Bible school incident, or is this something that's their theme?
Well, I don't have like a particular situation.
Yeah, but hypothetically, they're different.
Yeah, if it's like, oh, this person is doing that to a lot of people and not just me, and that person is hurt and hurting others, then I guess you'd say, I need to talk to them or talk to the church leadership. But if it was a one-off, I'm trying to answer my own question. You know, if it's a one-off, you just say, I'm going to have grace for them because I'm a sinner and my little me is just upset. And I don't need to talk to him about it.
Here's some thoughts, because that's a really complicated question and a good one, Lauren.
Nailed it.
She was so sweet to me earlier, and now I feel horrible.
No, don't feel bad.
No shame. Let's put it a little bit in the context of, let's say, perhaps, let's call her Susie. Let's say Susie is somebody who's a bit difficult. She's hard to work with. She's bossy, controlling, talks behind your back. She's hard. That's what she does. And you remember that, and it still hurts you. Now, if that's that far in the past, my first question is going to be, what do I need to do? And I'm assuming that she's not aware of this and maybe not repentant. My first question is, what do I need to do to no longer be about the distinction between forgiveness versus being set free? In other words, with some people who have injured us, they may be dead. How do we resolve that? They've hurt me and I'm walking around carrying this injury and I think about it. It's never crossing their mind. And one of the things I talk about in that talk is that a question we have at that point is, what needs to happen in my heart for them to no longer own that part of me that they hurt? All right? And in that sense, that's not technically forgiveness. It's technically a form of individuation. Remember I was talking about, like, why do we give other people's opinions so much power over us? I would want to think, okay, why do I keep holding on to that? What's in it? What do I need to have to let go of it? But my second question would be this. Let's say this is kind of her style. I want to be asking myself, so what does that mean that I'm going to do next time she does it to me? I don't need to get into church leadership, whatever like that. I just want to be aware if she is going to be bossy and control-y, her way or the highway, I want to go ahead and anticipate. This isn't my first rodeo. So I don't want to address the past. I want to address being ready for the future. So I get assigned to work with her in Bible school again, and I know she's going to do this stuff. I want to be ready. And when she says, yeah, you always do this and you always do that, for you to be able to say, Susie, I think you and I both bring a lot of mistakes to the table on this. I'm going to take the lead here and say, we're not going to be unkind to each other about that. And you stand with this force against it. And you're now more in a position of power that's, how do I respond to this hurtful person rather than how do I deal with how this hurtful person treated me? That's a lot of the gist about unrepentant people, is we talk a lot about the ugly thing they said, and I want to be more in a position to alpha them in a loving way. So I tell this story in one of my talks. I was staying with this family, and the teenage boy in the family was always critical of what people were wearing, and he had mentioned some of my own clothes, and he was just this judgy little twerp. And I'm just totally annoyed by him. So I'm like, okay, well, then what do you want to do next time he does it? And I'm like, okay, now I'm not in the victim position anymore. This little twerp walking around criticizing people. So we were sitting around, and later on he said, your shoes look dumb. And I said, and you think a whole lot about what other people wear, don't you? And it doesn't feel good. And he was just silent. In other words, I want to take stewardship of having loving power with an unrepentant, hurtful person. That's what I would do most. Now, if it's a relationship who's a close friend, a relationship in which there's dynamics that go back and forth, and it kind of is a theme, then I would want to approach in a real mutual win-win way of, I keep feeling this dynamic, and I love the curiosity and humility thing, especially for somebody who's remotely repentant. I want to say, I might be seeing this wrong. This might be me. But I keep feeling like, it's like Norma said to me a while back. I was just in this picky, obnoxious, talk about being a twerp. Norma said, it just seems like kind of everything I do today, you just are kind of picking at. And I was like, yeah, you're right, I am. But I want to, she was in essence saying, I'm not sure, but I think this is what's going on. I want to say, hey, Susie, I'm not sure, but it feels like you and I can get in a little tit for tat about this or that, and I don't want us to do that. And as I felt it before, and I want us to repair it. And if she's humble, she ought to go, yeah, I felt that too. If she's not willing to hear it, then you need to deal more in an unrepentant dynamic and set more limits. Good?
Okay. That's helpful.
All right. See why I avoided the unrepentant thing tonight, because it really throws everything into sort of 4D. Tonight was dealing with repentant people. I'm glad for these unrepentant questions, though, because they are so much a part of the story. Great. Yes, ma'am.
So you mentioned that you were going to touch on loss and pain more tomorrow.
Yes.
But I wanted to take just a little time to hear your thoughts on it. I'll phrase it as a question, but just feel free to explain. However, for people who experience that brush with badness as loss, you talked about with shame how the unhealthy response is judgment and how a healthier response is that godly sorrow or contriteness. Where in your practice do you see an unhealthy response to loss, our natural default, and then where with emotional software do you see a healthier response to loss?
Sorry. One of the perks of being a psychologist is you learn to grow comfortable with long periods of silence. So I'm not
I was
awkward,
a teacher,
sorry.
So I'm used to silence too.
If I'm making
too,
y'all
you're
awkward,
good.
I'm not gonna softball your question. I could make a case for every psychopathology we have being a way that we are trying to not face loss. Depression. People who are always sad and depressed. That's impossible. If you are truly sad, you will not get depressed. Because depression happens when I am feeling so much loss or pain or a part of me I can't tolerate and I don't know what to do with it. So I shut my soul down to not experience the pain. Now, the problem is our hearts don't have a lot of breaker switches on them like your house does. They just have one breaker switch. And if you throw the breaker switch to your heart to the pain, you throw the breaker switch to your heart to everything else, and you stop feeling the pain, and what you start feeling is the deadness of depression. Let's pick another one. Anxiety. What's my anxiety? I don't want to face loss. Oh, let's go back to the anxiety I had this week about not impressing y'all. Okay? So what's the cure to that? Well, one of my cures was I grabbed one of my safe people, which we'll talk about tomorrow, and I said, will you be with me because I've had a cold, I've never done this conference, and I'll be really embarrassed if I screw up in Fort Worth. And they're like, you know what? No matter what happens in Fort Worth, I love you big. And it's like I needed to be connected in it. But the other thing I had to do was, can I face the loss of not being amazing? Anxiety is healed as I face loss. Pick any out of control behavior. I feel empty, so I use that to make myself feel better. I don't want to feel the loss. All right, so most pathology is about feeling loss. Now, what? Let's go back to depression, because this is a good example of how we engage loss. You can see why depressed people get really stuck and are really in a fix. Because, now, what are their options? To stay dead and depressed, or to throw back on the breaker switch and feel all that pain again? Gag. You can see why they get really despairing and hopeless. So, let's see how smart y'all are. What might help them be able to cut the breaker switch back on and actually endure and go back and face that loss, that pain? What might help them do that? Connection! Yes! In other words, the secret of the universe is somehow a feeling you can't tolerate by yourself, if you get connected with somebody else. We don't avoid loss because it's no fun. We avoid loss because it feels like it'll kill us. All right? So the only way to go back into something that feels like it's going to kill us is I need to have somebody with me. We'll talk about this tomorrow some, and that is that one of little John Coxism, pain with is halved. Pain alone is doubled. And so as long as we're alone in our pain, we're in a really stinky spot because we can't manage it, so we'll do stupid stuff to avoid it, which is the source of all our symptoms. Okay? So you connect with somebody, they start to engage with you, and y'all together have the ability to face the unfaceable. They can cut the switch back on and they get out of their depression. And then they cry a lot because now they're sad. And sad is our healthiest place, which we'll talk about tomorrow. Let's do one more. I'm getting a little woozy. Let me do another phoner. How does one grow in their muscle of individuation? Cool. Y'all are good. We're going to talk about how to grow tomorrow, but I'll give you a hint. The matrix of any kind of growth is relationship. Okay? The reason therapy works is not because of the amazing wisdom of Dr. John L. Cox, remember? It's because you put something that's incomplete in a relationship and y'all can help complete it. So what do I need if I need individuation? I just gave you an example of it. When I was talking about loss and managing my fear or shame about not being amazing in front of y'all, what did that person help me do? They helped me individuate from what y'all might think. What helps us build individuation is somebody, number one, who says, I love you, and our connection is fast. I hold on to you. You're not going to lose me if you're you. So you can start experimenting with who you is. And I got your back if other people don't like you. All right? And also people who actually embrace and encourage our individuation. I had this friend who used to hate to say no. And I took it upon myself. I told him this. I said, you're my personal mission. I'm going to teach you to say no. So I go, hey, you want to try to have lunch next couple weeks? He'd go, yeah, man, that'd be great. I'll look at my book. And he would never look at his book. And so one day I'm like, you want to have lunch a couple weeks? He goes, yeah. I'm like, dude, just say no. He goes, no, I want to do it. I'm like, no, say it with me. No. I'll love you anyway. Just try it. And he goes, I really am really busy. I'm like, I know you are. Say it. And he's like, no. I'm like, yeah, okay. Anyway, so I was gaming with him, but what builds identity is the safety to be curious, the safety to start being me, the safety to disappoint you. I had a client recently who was really working on this issue of being a people pleaser, doing what you're supposed to do, not disappointing other people, not making choices out of her own heart, not being a good steward. She was a puppet of everybody in her life. And we had done really good work. And she says to me, I was thinking, just for a little season during the holidays, I mean, money's a little tight, that I might cut back to every other week. But I wanted to run that by you. And I said, what do you think I would say? And she smiled. And I said, do you find any irony in the fact that I've spent the last 6 months getting you to be you? And that you would come in here with your first act as you. I'm going to pull away from you and only come every other week. And I'm going to go, no, no, no. You think I'm going to do that? No, you do it, girl. You go. You can change your mind. In other words, we need a cheerleader to help us have the safety to be me. Because there's a lot of people in the world who are going to say, I don't want you to be me. Don't want you to be you. And we need to have a strong home base, community, if you will, where we know, like, who I am is welcomed, warts and all. That's what unshames us. And once we're unshamed, we can start to really be who we are in God's image without play acting. That's individuating. Does that make sense? All right, good. All right. You guys, I've put you through it. Tomorrow actually will be easier, I think. But I'm kind of pleased how it worked, too. I think it worked. Yeah. Thank you. No, thank y'all. I'm relieved. Let me pray. You want to pray or you want me to pray?
Yeah, you go for it.
Okay. My favorite times about tonight is when we kept thinking about you. I love how if we just start asking questions about what it means to be a person who is small or broken or needful, we turn around and there you are. Love looks over and over again, whether it be about what love looks like, or what the safety to be a steward looks like, or what being free from shame looks like, or what being weak looks like. Whenever we look in that place that feels so dark to us, there you are. I don't really have a closing prayer point, except just that we worship you. We worship you in that. Amen.